So my job is an anaesthetist or an anaesthesiologist. Professionally, I put people to sleep. Hopefully, that won't be what I do over the next half an hour. Yes, that's the joke that all anaesthetists start a talk to a non-medical audience. As Danny said, I'm a product of this community here. I went to Anglican, graduated in 2000, and attended this congregation for about 7 years. Every time I come, we try and come each summer, and Chuck reminds me that I was the youngest participating member of the early morning Bible study and still hold that record. As Danny said, I went on to study medicine, so I'm going to stick to what I know and talk more about the intersection of my profession and my faith. And I want to present a series of four reflections. Now, reflections are a personal thing. They're born out of particular circumstances, and they may or may not resonate with you as the hearer. Danny has already given you a quick bio about me, and I think it's probably important just to expand a little bit on my background, because that will probably be useful for you to understand where these reflections are coming from and help you to weigh those. As my accent and my self-deprecating humour is probably already betrayed, I'm originally British. After graduating from Anglican, I went to Manchester and studied medicine. That was almost 20 years ago now. Over that time, a lot's changed. I've got married to Rena. We've got two lovely kids, Aidan and Eva. And I, after medical school, went to specialise in anaesthesia and intensive care medicine. And that's what I spend my day job doing now. So we live in Manchester, and I work at one of our local hospitals where I'm the deputy director of intensive care. And I think it's fair to say, while I still practice as an anaesthetist, my heart and passion and probably a lot of these reflections are born more out of my intensive care practice rather than anaesthesia. Medicine's been something that I've been very certain that I wanted to do from quite a young age. So from age 4 or 5, I had this sense that I wanted to be a doctor. Throughout school, I was strong at sciences and was able to get into medical school. And I suppose my journey throughout education has been one where that vision and understanding of what it is to be a doctor, you know, sort of a 4-year-old's understanding of what a doctor does, to now almost a 40-year-old's understanding of what it is to be a doctor, has changed over that time. A lot of these experiences that I'm going to share are drawn out of intensive care medicine, so I just want to briefly explain what intensive care is. In the UK, about 3% of our hospital beds are intensive care beds. In other countries, in Israel and the States, it's closer to 10%. So we look after the sickest patients in the hospital there. The majority of my patients, when they're referred to me, are close to dying and would die without our interventions. And, you know, 20 to 30% of the patients that that we look after actually don't survive and do die. So that's kind of the environment that I work in. Of those patients that do survive, a lot go on to have physical, psychological sequelae as a result of their stay in intensive care. So on to the four reflections that I'm going to share. The first one is that our bodies are amazing. The second one is look after your body. The third one is a reminder that we're mortal. And then the final one is just some thoughts on what is the role of the physician, what is the role of the doctor. So our bodies are amazing. Psalm 139, verse 14. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. I don't think it comes as any surprise to any of you for me to state that your bodies are amazing. You've all seen people achieve amazing feats, be they physical sporting activities, be they amazing sort of achievements, climbing massive mountains, solo climbing up El Capitan, or intellectual feats. Our bodies are truly amazing. medical school, I really enjoyed learning about how our bodies work, how our body works together. And it works together at each individual level, from the organ systems working together to keep the person alive, from the individual cells within each organ working towards that function of the organ, and then also at a cellular level, so within the cells there are organelles, so those are sort of organs within a cell that actually function to keep the cell doing what it's supposed to do. And then on a molecular level, these organelles are made out of various different chemicals, DNA, proteins, fats, carbohydrates. And the image of the church that Paul gives us of being hands, feet, arms, eyes, mouths, works sort of on that gross level, but it also works on each different level, all the way down to the molecular level. Our body is working together. And it's not just the organization of the body which is amazing, but it's the internal functioning and control of how it works. It's often said we live in a soundbite generation. We like simplistic understandings of how things work. We like to talk in terms of goodies and baddies, or A has caused B. And the way that the body works is much more complex. There's sort of a complex web of different factors interacting with each other. I guess an example of this came from quite early on in my studies when I was doing a neuroscience degree. I was doing a project working on nerve growth factors. So nerve growth factors, a small protein, and it's very important for the survival of nerve tissue, brain cells and neurons. And my friend and I were chatting, and we sort of got carried away and thought, wow, wouldn't it be amazing if we could sort of find some way of delivering nerve growth factor to every single cell, nerve cell within the body? You could potentially stop brain degeneration and therefore prevent sort of brain aging. And that was a really simplistic way of us to be looking at things, because actually, well, nerve growth factor is an important element of how nerves remain alive. There are hundreds of other different factors that keep a nerve alive, and it's not just one simple panacea that will keep the nerve cells alive. But I think our thinking was even more problematic in the idea that we wanted to keep all nerve cells alive, because actually the nervous system is constantly changing. There's cell death, there's regeneration, and there's the changing shapes of nerve cells. And that's how our brain functions. That's how we create memories. That's how we learn new skills. So the idea that we want to keep the brain in this static condition was actually a very flawed way of thinking. And that conversation I sometimes hark back to in my mind, because it's very very much the way that we think medically. So we often, whether it be through surgical techniques or pharmacological interventions, we're often looking to approach the body in a very simplistic way. We don't have the skill to be understanding and interacting with this complex web of regulation that naturally exists within the body. And what we're actually doing is sort of blasting away with a big mallet often. There are side effects to the interventions we have. There are benefits. Hopefully the benefits outweigh the side effects. You know, and I guess I could be sounding a little bit negative about medicine here. I'm very thankful for it, but I think it's important that we're cognizant that what we have to offer from a medical perspective in terms of the body does not interact at the level at which it was created. A verse that I often reflect on in my own thinking about our inabilities to fully interact with the body at the level that God's created, it's Isaiah 55:9. So God says, "As the heavens are higher above the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts higher than your thoughts." My second reflection is, look after your bodies. 1 Corinthians 6:19 to 20. "Do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, who is in you, whom have you received from God? You are not your own. You were bought with a price. Therefore, honour God with your bodies. So if we look at sort of the scientific literature that would suggest, you know, what is a healthy lifestyle, there are some common recurring themes. Healthy eating, regular exercise, absence of addiction, hygiene, good sleep, social contact, management of stress. So I'm not talking about the sort of things that come up every so often, which will advocate, you know, sort of going on a full diet of rhubarb or completely stopping one practice or another. I'm trying to think about, you know, sort of what's the more balanced approach to things and themes that are recurring within the scientific literature. And I would argue that what is looking after our bodies, what is a healthy lifestyle, is actually very much in line with what God teaches us about using our bodies. Now, various traditions of Christianity have taken on the vices of alcohol and smoking on quite frequently. So I wanted to avoid those, but actually talk about exercise and a healthy diet, because I've never heard a sermon on exercise or a healthy diet. So regular exercise. Our bodies were designed for hard work. Now, whether you want to take an evolutionary perspective of things or a creation perspective, you know, even evolutionary biology would suggest that we were hunters, gatherers running along the plains of Africa. The Genesis account, God puts man in the Garden of Eden and tells him to look after the garden. After the fall, God tells him that the work's going to be a heck lot harder than it was to start off with. So our bodies were designed for hard work. The modern way of living is we've developed lots of machines that do a lot of that hard work, and we live more sedentary lifestyles, sitting down. Our bodies are less active than they were designed to be. Our minds are much, much more active than they were designed to be. There's good evidence that you can redress that balance with physical activity. So there's good evidence that you can get a lot of that exercise that we would otherwise be getting from labouring in the fields by actually going out and doing some exercise. Likewise, there's lots of good mental health benefits from doing regular exercise, and the sort of overworking of the brain that we do within a modern lifestyle is very much has negative mental health properties. So the exercise counteracts that. Healthy eating. So I say this this next section as someone who has, for the most of my life, been a little bit on the heavier side and really enjoyed food. The health costs of obesity are similar to the health costs of tobacco and alcohol. That's something that we don't talk much about in society. But that is something that is recognised within the medical literature. When I'm talking about healthy eating, I'm probably talking about a diet that's largely fruits and vegetables, a bit of meat every so often, and really minimising processed foods. So I was thinking about how to back this thinking up biblically, and I don't have any strong reference verses for this, but I thought the sort of concept of gluttony was quite useful to look at. So in the NIV version, the word glutton appears 7 times. 4 of those 7 times it's within the context of drunkenness, so the glutton and drunkard. And in my mind, I think what the Bible's teaching is to avoid excesses, to avoid addictions. Just returning to 1 Corinthians 6, Paul says, I have the right to do anything, but not everything is beneficial. I have the right to do anything, but I will not. The translations, particularly the King James, puts in the phrase, all things in moderation. So I think a healthy lifestyle is about moderation. I think there are two caveats to put in there. The first caveat is a healthy lifestyle can become something that one becomes obsessed about, an idol, if you like. We all know the person who is difficult to invite round because they have such a complex diet to follow. It's often easier to say, you suggest a restaurant that we go to and I'll pay for it. Likewise, we all know the person who's so obsessed about exercise, it's very difficult to do much because their life's planned around their exercise regime. I challenge us to think about healthy eating and exercise. I would also challenge us to think about how we do that in moderation, because life is more than just living a healthy lifestyle. I think the second caveat is we can often get drawn to simplistic thinking. Lots of patients that I see, well, the relatives of patients I see who've become really ill quickly, one of the common themes that a relative will say is, but he's always exercising, he's always eaten the right thing, he's always lived a healthy lifestyle. So, well, living that healthy lifestyle is protective for good health. It's not a guarantee of good health. And I suppose in this point I'm reminded of John 9, where there's the issue of the blind man that Jesus heals, and the question arises, who sinned, this man or his parents? And Jesus says, well, it's not about sin at all, it's about so that my glory can be seen. And I think the same is true in terms of healthy lifestyle as well. A healthy lifestyle will help you look after your bodies and use your bodies in a way that God intended you to do. It will make it less likely that you become ill, but it doesn't guarantee that. My next reflection, we are mortal. This reflection was initially entitled, You Will Die. She's 10, said, you can't stand up and tell everyone they're going to die. So instead, I'm going to come up here and remind you of your mortality. Some have said that there are two certainties in life, taxes and death. Others have said, start living until you come to terms and come to peace with the fact that we're going to die. Our modern lives have become devoid of a lot of the reminders that were historically there about our own mortality. Looking after animals, looking after our own sick and dying were things that historically were done by everyone, by households. These have now become niche professions, so we tend not to associate the meat that we eat with the raising and slaughtering of animals. Likewise, a lot of the things that go around death are hived off in hospitals. And I'm one of the people that's privileged to see people in their last minutes and hours as they die. And I just wanted to bring you a reminder, hopefully not a timely reminder, but a reminder that we are mortal. And I think it's an important point to reflect on that. My final reflection is what's the role of a physician? I've already talked about how amazing our bodies are and how the tools that I have as a doctor are actually quite coarse and don't have the complexity to interact with the body on at the level it's designed. I've just reminded you that we're all going to die at some point. There are things that we can do with modern medicine that can modify the process of disease, that can make catching diseases less likely, that can alter the course of dying. But there's ultimately death. A lot of my thinking in terms of what's the role of a doctor has come by a guy called Stanley Hauerwas, who's an American theologian. I've left his books at home, so I can't quote him directly. I can just plagiarize him from memory. But he argues that the role of what he calls a physician, but essentially a healthcare worker, is to care. Well, I'm a believer. Well, I believe in the power of healing. My training is very much within the biomedical paradigm of how the bodies work. My special skill isn't to heal. And if I'm perfectly honest, there are very few diseases I can think of where modern medicine can actually heal a person. And Hauervaas thinks about this and says, well, actually, the role of someone working in healthcare, the role of a believer working in healthcare is to care for those who come into his path or her path and care for them. I just want to provide a few examples of caring, but I think first there's a few caveats. First of all, this is a very much a work in action for me. The second one is, and this is something that my wife and children will very much attest to, I'm often not the most empathetic of people. Often when someone has a small graze or something's aching a little bit, my response isn't the most empathetic, and my wife's often the right address for a more more caring attitude. There's an ongoing debate in society and specifically in medicine about what's the value of soft skills, communication, teamwork, over technical skills. And there's this myth, this urban myth of the skillful surgeon. So this is a surgeon who could be a he or a she, most likely to be a he, who's not pleasant to his patients, not pleasant to his colleagues. He's a real pain to work with. But technically, he's amazing. He can, he'll take on the most complex cases and he'll get good results. But he's a real pain to be around just because he's so arrogant and unpleasant. I think this person's a myth, actually. There's increasingly a lot of studies coming out looking at the team working within an operating department. And teams which don't work well, that are headed by an arrogant surgeon, actually have higher complication rates than teams that are led by a better working team and more pleasant comments to each other. Medical care is teamwork, and you know, now as a senior doctor, I see one of my responsibilities very much looking after my team, learning how to work alongside my team, because there's very little that I can do just by myself. I need all those people around me to be there, and that's how I care for my patients, is by sort of trying to engender that that team working together. Often my patients are unconscious, so it's often falls to me to have a chat with the relatives and loved ones of the patient. Normally, the sickness, the illness that's brought them to my attention has come on exceptionally quickly, and it's a high-stakes conversation. I have quite a lot of unpleasant news normally to pass on. And I think within my own practice, that's one area that I feel quite strongly that I can really care for those that come to me. I often don't have any guarantees that the patient's going to get better. But what I can offer is some guidance through what might be expected to happen, because that is one of my areas of expertise. Well, I can't give an absolute definition of what will happen. I can suggest the path that might unfold. And I think that that sense of standing alongside people in suffering is quite important. As Danny said, I've done a few interest in things. One of the things I was privileged to do was be involved in the 2014-15 response to the Ebola pandemic in West Africa. So I went there as part of a research team. My team was hoping to trial new drugs that may be a treatment for Ebola. The situation on the ground was dire. This was a disease that was spreading like wildfire and killing 70 to 80% of people who caught it. While we were going there to test new treatments, the chances that these treatments would actually benefit that region at that point in time were very low. And that was assuming that we'd find something successful. There was eventually quite a large response from Western countries. And the truth was that that response wasn't able really to do all that much for the patients. There was some symptomatic relief that could be offered to the patients. But the main thing that we probably did of any value was separate infected people from the rest of the population to try and prevent the spread of the disease. And, you know, after a few weeks of being there and realising the futility of the situation, I spoke with one of the Liberian nurses I was working on and said, you know, what do you think about Western countries coming and helping you out? You know, it's because I'm not too sure we've all got all that much to offer here. And what he said was quite profound. He said, you know, in the hour of our need and suffering, you've come and you've stood shoulder to shoulder with us. And I think that, you know, that was quite a powerful message to me at that time and still serves as a reminder of what my role is. Just going to draw my reflections to a close now. God's given us amazing bodies. Rejoice about that. Learn about how your bodies work, because as you learn about how they work, you'll be able to look after them better. And the more you learn about them, the more you will be filled with awe and inspiration at the design and the creation of how God's put us together. I think my calling as a doctor is probably not all that different from everyone else's calling. Essentially, we're called to love those around us. In my particular circumstance, those around me will often be suffering and diseased. And finally, in all issues of health, in spite of what medical science has to offer, God remains sovereign in all these issues. Thank you.